I'm John Fort. You're listening to CNBC's Tech Check. Our show is live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Listen in.
Good Thursday morning. Welcome to Tech Check. I'm Carl Quintanilla with John Fort and Julia Boorstin. Today, it has been a volatile 24 hours. The NASDAQ rallying more than 2% yesterday, down again this morning. We got two members of the PayPal mafia, investors David Sachs and Keith Raboy, to talk about why it's been such a tough 2 months for tech, even as broader indexes remain near record highs. Speaking of a stock that's done well, Adobe, falling sharply despite this revenue beat. What cloud and software stocks, if any, are safe to own right now? Plus one IPO to come in 2022, Reddit, confidentially filing to go public. We're going to talk with some early investors in the company this hour, John.
Yeah, and we will start with Adobe and falling cloud-related stocks. Cloud and software names have been at the center of the sell-off in tech. Those ETFs down double digits in the last month. Hit hardest have been companies that don't yet have profits or where the multiples are highest. As for Adobe, well, that's not the case with that company. Earnings in line, revenue beats. It's the Q1 guide that's coming in below some estimates. Shares are falling sharply this morning. CEO Shantanu Narayen, who we spoke to on Monday, is on the call, which is starting as we speak. He'll be on Mad Money tonight at 6. Lastly, we will just point out Adobe still up 15% year to date. And if you go out multiple years, it's one of the single best performing stocks in the S&P. Market cap right near $300 billion. Guys, it's rough in the daily action, of course, but given how much a stock like this has been up over the last several years, if you told me in January it would be up 15% at the end of the year, pretty good. But I think it speaks to the whole valuation question that we've been asking again and again, and how investors are going to treat these stocks, even ones that have a good amount, Julia, of growth and momentum in them.
Yeah, I mean, Adobe is such a fascinating one because on one hand, the tools that they have been offering, they've been introducing new tools, are incredibly valuable. You see the value proposition for their customers. On the other hand, they do face an incredible amount of competition in that space, and particularly in some of the new areas that they're pushing into. But when you look at what's weighing on the stock, Carl, it's really about the outlook. And there is so much uncertainty right now. I think the uncertainty is in large part about this question of whether or not the growth that companies like Adobe have seen are a result of that growth is really a result of a pull forward or whether it's a permanent acceleration of a trend. And we just don't know. And a lot of that is something that we're going to have to see over the next 6 months, Carl.
Yeah, we should also tell our viewers about the revenue projection that's really responsible for the sell-off today, John. They're looking for 2022 revenue 17.9. Street was 18.2. I mean, that's a very marginal miss. And Cramer's point this morning was that maybe some were looking at the high side of the range of estimates and selling in what Jim called a panic. He's going to, as you said, have Shantanu Narayen on tonight, but warned this morning investors against getting too nervous about that outlook.
Yeah, this is not a bombastic company or a bombastic CEO, so you wouldn't expect Adobe necessarily to, in an uncertain environment, be too out there perhaps about projections. So that is to keep in mind. But of course, we'll want to see what Shantanu specifically has to say about the quarter. Now, we did talk to him on Monday, and part of what they are doing in the creative area of their business is this Adobe Express move, which is a bit of more of an on-ramp into the creative products. But, you know, we talked about metaverse to the degree that you believe that a metaverse is going to be overall a big opportunity. Adobe's digital creation tools certainly play there. But also the experience part of Adobe's business has to do with the buying process, digital buying, Carl, and omnichannel. So this isn't just a creative play. It's also a play in changing how businesses operate and how retail works. And, you know, we'll see how much of that plays into the guide as well.
Yeah. Meantime, our next guest says the crash is already here. It's just not being evenly distributed. Any number of stocks could illustrate that point. Look at Apple versus PayPal and Coupa over the last 2 months. Indexes at record highs. Apple's up 24%. And yet, recent IPOs, ARK funds, high multiple companies down sharply. Joining us this morning, Kraft Ventures co-founder David Sachs, an early investor in Affirm, Airbnb, Facebook, Lyft, Opendoor, Palantir, you name it, SpaceX, Twitter, just to name a few. David, it's good to have you. Welcome back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
What do you think is the delineation between names that are getting punished and those that are not on a relative basis?
I think it's mostly about whether they're growth stocks and how long dated they are compared to, you know, value stocks. Obviously, if interest rates are going up, then that increases the discount rate on those future earnings and they're worth less in the present. So that's basically what's been going on. If you look at kind of the performance of growth stocks over the last 5 or 6 weeks, they kind of hit all-time highs around November 8th. That was the day that you had, you know, at least three Fed governors, you know, make very hawkish announcements about rate increases in response to an inflation print that was much higher than expected, around 6.8%. We've been told by the administration that inflation was transitory. Obviously, it's been more persistent than was expected. And so as a result of that, the market's been trying to price in these rate increases for the last 5-6 weeks. And that's really hurt growth stocks. So, you know, from where I sit as a VC in Silicon Valley, in a way, we're investing in the most growth of growth stocks. We're invested in the most long-dated companies, the companies that have their earnings in furthest in the future. And so as a result of that, there's been sort of a trickle-down effect from the public markets to, I think, growth stage investors. And we're all kind of waiting for the VC market to find a new level.
Right. Do you believe that some of the growth drivers have truly dissipated because we are so in exiting a so-called COVID era, hopefully in the near future? What's durable in the way of growth drivers? And also, I should point out, the bond market's not completely convinced the Fed is going to be as hawkish as they communicated yesterday.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we've had a rally. We basically had a huge relief rally yesterday in the sort of second half of the market. I think there's two reasons for that. One is just the Fed finally provided some certainty and it was in line with what people were expecting. But the other piece of good news that we got, frankly, was that the BBB, the Build Back Better bill, has been shelved till March. And the last thing we really needed in this sort of inflationary environment is $5 trillion of new spending, sort of pressurizing the situation. So I think the market kind of got what it wanted to hear yesterday in terms of finally getting some certainty out of the Fed in that was in line with their expectations. And then we finally got some good news out of Washington. I mean, in terms of the economy itself, there's a lot of strength there. The Fed, you know, predicted 4% GDP growth next year. I don't think we have a problem in the real economy from where I sit right now. It's just been a tremendous amount of uncertainty created by policymakers in Washington, having this, you know, huge fiscal expansion, a lot of new taxes. There was, you know, rates. There was a lot of uncertainty coming out of Washington. And I think if policymakers would just let things sort of settle down, I think, you know, next year could be a good year for the real economy.
David, it's so interesting to me that certain stocks that really got a bid during the pandemic have come down almost to the levels where they were as the pandemic was just beginning. I'm thinking about Zoom and Peloton in particular. I think you mentioned PayPal. But then at the same time, I look at Samsara, right, which came public just yesterday. Healthy valuation, I think many would argue, around $11, $12 billion. And no big IPO pop, no problem with that. And it's trading so far evenly today. What does that tell you perhaps about what was in the market before when we saw these wild fluctuations that are now getting worked out? What's healthy and what's not?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So from my point of view, the same things that I've always invested in, it's the same things I'm going to continue investing in, which is, you know, is SaaS, it's business software, SaaS, you know, B2B software that's moved to the cloud, often has a sort of highly consumerized go-to-market motion where you appeal to the employees of the company, let them sign up. So I'm investing in the same things I've always invested in. The only thing that's really changed is the price levels. You know, last year you saw, you know, AR multiples get to a really pretty insane level. You saw, I'd say, like almost the norm was 100 times ARR. Just 2 or 3 years ago, I'd say 20 times ARR was much more the norm. So what you've really seen now is that you've had, call it a 30, 40% correction in these growth stocks, including SaaS, which I invest in. And so now I think the VC markets are going to reset a little bit, and we'll find out what the new price levels are when deals get done over the next few months by top tier firms. So I would say, you know, for me, it's not like what I invest in has changed. It's just that the price levels have changed. And frankly, you know, the thing that I find disturbing is the extent to which all the investors I know are now macroeconomists. You know, I mean, every investor I know in whether it's real estate or venture or crypto or what have you, the only thing they're talking about right now is the macro picture and interest rates. And what we should be talking about are, you know, the company we want to invest in, or the building we want to buy, or, you know, which protocol makes sense. And we've all been turned into macro economists by all the uncertainty that's coming out of Washington. And I think it would be a really good thing, again, if policymakers would just leave things alone now and let the economy do what it does best.
David, let's pivot over to meme stocks, IPOs, and Wall Street bets. Speaking of individual companies, Reddit, the social media platform at the heart of the meme stock frenzy, has confidentially filed to go public. The company was valued at more than $10 billion after a funding round back in August. Now, David, I know you were an early investor in Reddit. I am very much looking forward to seeing all of its financials in that S-1 filing when we eventually get our hands on it. But I'm wondering what you think about this timing. This is a company that's been around for a while. Why does it make sense to do it right now? Should they have done it a year ago at the peak of that meme stock frenzy?
Well, you know, what I always tell our portfolio companies is that you raise money when you need it. And, you know, just the valuation levels and, you know, what the pricing will ultimately be determined by the market. And, you know, don't worry too much about trying to time those types of things. Just focus on what's good for your business. If it makes sense to raise money, if it would be helpful to become a public company, then you do that and you just try to weather the market conditions. And sometimes you'll have tailwinds and sometimes you'll have headwinds, but you do what's right for the business. I think that with Reddit, they've reached a point of maturity in their business where they can go public. What they've been working on for the last few years is building out their advertising and their revenue. This is one of those sort of social media companies that people always said, oh, they'll never make money. No one wants to advertise against, you know, their inventory. The content is too raunchy or racy or what have you. And so there was always, you know, this sort of idea that it would not monetize. And I think what they've proven over the last few years is that they can sell advertising against that massive amount of traffic they've had. Like you said, I'm an investor in the company, but I'm generally bullish because Reddit is just such an enormous site. I mean, I think in terms of traffic, it's one of the top five sites on the internet. So I'm generally bullish. And, you know, I think the reason for them to go public is because it makes sense for their business now.
Hey, finally, David, I wonder, you know, you talk about Washington and the uncertainty over fiscal policy and tax policy. What's your take on how they've communicated regulatory policy and whether or not they're getting in the way of efficient capital structures? Or do you think that they've been responsible in trying to keep up with the innovation we've seen over the last few years?
Well, I one of the areas I'm concerned about regulatory-wise is M&A. I mean, I think that, you know, some of the pronouncements you've gotten out of the DOJ and the FTC, they've really thrown a wet blanket on M&A activity. And, you know, if you're sitting where I'm sitting as an investor in really the riskiest companies, okay, the part of the economy where we're expecting most of the bets to become zeros, and we're hoping that, you know, a handful of them will more than make up for that. There's really only two good outcomes, right? The third is sort of bankruptcy. The company winds down, but there's only two good outcomes. One is IPO or going public, maybe it's a SPAC, but somehow becoming a public listing. The other is M&A. And if you take M&A off the table, you really put a damper on the type of investing in risk capital that I do, the funding of anyone with a good idea. And I think that, you know, obviously while M&A has not been prohibited, they've now created so much uncertainty that I think all of the big tech companies are at least afraid to engage in it because they're afraid of their deal getting hung up in sort of regulatory scrutiny. So I think what we need is a lot more clarity out of Washington with respect to M&A. If there are certain types of deals that can happen, tell us what they are, but otherwise turn M&A back on, because I think otherwise it's going to have a huge dampening effect over, again, the sort of the risk investing that we do that really paves the way for the next generation of great American companies.
David, it's a really good a signpost for where we are at the moment, whether it's valuations or policy. We're very much appreciative. Good to see you again. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, we'll talk streaming, Spider-Man, and much more with the chairman of Sony Pictures. Tech Check is just getting started.
Time now for a gut check on Disney. Shares are about flat this morning after being named one of Citi's contrarian bulls for 2022. Disney joining Alibaba, AT&T, and PayPal on that list. Citi making these picks by choosing among the 10 worst performers over the last year to try to identify some value. And Disney fits the description, down more than 16% year to date, Julia.
Speaking of media giants, this movie is expected to be the biggest film of the year. It's Sony's next Spider-Man film, No Way Home, and it's anticipated to bring in over $100 million in North America this weekend. That would make it the biggest opening weekend since the pandemic began. Joining us now is Tony Vinciquerra. He's Sony Pictures chairman and CEO. Tony, thank you so much for joining us. I know there's a lot of excitement for this film, but my question is, what do you think is going to happen both this weekend and over the holiday season with rising concerns about Omicron?
Well, Julie, if we only do 100 million, we're going to be very, very disappointed. So our sights are much higher than that. So let's keep our fingers crossed. But look, I think, it's an unknown what's going to happen with the Omicron variant. But look, we've sold so many tickets in the pre-sale. We're guaranteed it's going to do really, really well, both here and around the world. In fact, it opened in Korea two days ago, and did very well. It was the biggest opening of the pandemic.
Okay, I've seen estimates in the 150 million plus range, but I guess one thing that's so interesting is, you know, this is an exclusive theatrical release. You're going to have an exclusive theatrical window. That's the decision you're making for your films. But as you look into next year, what's your outlook for the future of theatrical movie going? Do you think that you're going to be doing some simultaneous releases or shorter windows? What does movie going and theatrical releases have to look like in this new hybrid future that we're in?
Well, obviously, we're going to have to remain very agile about how we release films, but our focus is entirely on theatrical for our big IP, such as Spider-Man, such as Jumanji, such as, you know, many of the big films we have coming out. The Juno for Jordan, we're opening on Christmas Day with Denzel Washington, his directorial project, and also Michael B. Jordan's in that film. And then through next year, Morbius, Uncharted, all the big films we have, Where the Crawdads Sing, we're anticipating these will be only theatrical releases. We do have a deal, by the way, with Netflix, as we did in our upfront deal, or our Pay One deal, where we are producing films directly for Netflix. So you will see some of that. But look, our big IP is going to be theatrical.
Tony, what is the digital play here for the Spider-Man franchise? I mean, I know Disney's got Disney Plus, but you got PlayStation. I'm thinking about PS5 and the popular game there. I know my 13-year-old is very much into that. Do you see a lift around the movie engagement, the overall brand engagement, and what else is there that's specifically Sony that gets a lift in the platform play?
Well, you may have heard that we're very, very engaged with PlayStation with their IP. We have 10 projects in the works right now with PlayStation using their IP to produce film and television. The first will be Uncharted. It's a very, very good film, and I know you're all going to enjoy it with Tom Holland, who also is in Spider-Man, obviously, and also Mark Wahlberg. And that'll be released in February. We're really looking forward to that. And we have 9 projects, both combined with television and film, coming within the next couple of years. We also have a couple of projects we're working with PlayStation and with other parts of Sony to develop ways to distribute product that we're not quite ready to talk about yet, but you'll see some things happening over the next year in that reign.
Hey, Tony, Ann Sarnoff of Warner was asked about theatrical release strategy yesterday. I think she said, have we thought about going back to day and date? Sure, we've thought about it, but we've made our commitments to the theaters, to the agents, and to the talent. Is that a widely held view in Hollywood right now?
No, I think with us it is, Wardley. It is a firmly held view with us, but I think every studio has been experimenting as to how to go about releasing their films. One of the things that people have not talked about, I think, Julie, you and I talked about this very shortly a while ago, is that piracy, when you put these pure films out on digital platforms, piracy becomes rampant. So it's something you have to really be careful of, and that's something we're very concerned about. But look, we are, again, completely committed to theatrical for our big IP. We're going to continue that way. We have 15 films scheduled for release between now and the same day next year, and we're all in on that strategy. Now, will there be flexibility in how we move things around? It used to be when you scheduled a film, it was rock solid on that date. Not that way anymore. Things move, and the COVID-19 impact will continue, and we will be moving things around. We'll find ways to find the best place to release these films in theaters. We may hold some things, we may move them forward. I can't tell you how it's going to happen, but yeah, we're going to be very nimble, very agile.
Yeah, Tony, I always think it's important to mention that your business is not just about movies and TV production, but you also have all of these digital plays as well. And you've been pretty busy with M&A. You know, you acquired Crunchyroll. You've been selling off some international channels. Obviously, there's been a massive amount of M&A in the media space. In light of all that consolidation, as we await the merger, of Discovery and Warner Media, what do you think is next in terms of media M&A, and what are you interested in doing?
Well, you know, we for the last 4.5 years, we've been in the process of realigning our company to take advantage of the fact that we know what's happening as linear viewing goes to streaming viewing. We are, you know, for lack of a better term, the arms dealer in the marketplace right now, because no one else is selling the volume or product we are to all of the people who are fighting for subscriptions. We're also in, as you know, we're also in the SVOD business with our Funimation and Crunchyroll business, which we'll be combining in the near future. We have PureFlix, family and faith business. We have Sony Live in India, which is a massive, at today's numbers, about 8 million subscribers. So we're going to be focused on building new businesses and new communities of interest as we go forward. We're in the process of changing the tires on a moving car here, and it's been very successful and working very, very well for us.
Yeah, certainly Sony taking a different approach, being a supplier to the streamers and also those niche streaming options. Tony, thanks so much for talking to us today ahead of that big movie release.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Meanwhile, more bullish calls for the chip sector this morning. JPM naming Marvell, Broadcom, and KLA top picks for 2022. At the same time, Intel confirms it is planning to invest $7 billion in a chip plant in Malaysia. Intel up fractionally this morning. Tech Check is back after this.
Welcome back to Tech Check. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Julia Borshin and John Ford. Adobe and the chips, the biggest laggards on the NDX this morning. We've got that downgrade of DocuSign as well. Some bullish calls for Uber and Shop. More on all of that in just a moment. First, though, a news update with Rahel Solomon. Hi, Rahel.
Hi, Carl. Good morning. And here's what's happening at this hour. A massive pay clawback at McDonald's. Former CEO Steve Easterbrook is returning $105 million as part of a settlement after McDonald's learned that Easterbrook lied about the extent of his misconduct on the job. McDonald's says that those lies would have been enough to fire Easterbrook for cause back in 2019. Housing starts shot up nearly 12% in November. That is quadruple the growth that analysts had expected. Industrial production also growing strongly last month. And U.S. factories are busier than they've been since the pandemic began. Capacity utilization is at its highest level in 2 years. The Bank of England has become the first major central bank to raise interest rates, the move surprising many market watchers. Meanwhile, the European Central Bank has left its key interest rate unchanged and said that it will continue to reduce bond purchases under its pandemic support plan. And shares of Accenture surging 8% today and hitting a new all-time high. The consulting giant posted strong quarterly results, raised guidance, and says that it will continue to spend heavily on acquisitions. You're now up to date. John, I'll send it back to you.
Rahel, thank you. And we mentioned sectors and stocks that have undergone a re-rating the last few weeks. Fintech and the e-commerce ecosystem have been hit pretty hard. Platforms like Shopify and PayPal have seen a sharp pullback. Affirm and Block, formerly known as Square, down about 15-20%. Joining us now to discuss the future of the space, Founders Fund partner Keith Raboy, also now the CEO of OpenStore, a roll-up of Shopify businesses now valued just shy of $1 billion, and he sits on the board of Affirm as well. Keith, good to see you. It's interesting. I'm looking, we're talking about an overall pullback, but Shopify is still up around 15% for the year. Affirm is about even from where it first started trading. But yeah, as I mentioned, PayPal and Square down a bit. Is this a valuation reset or something more concerning?
Well, look, I think this is very straightforward. When you raise interest rates, or when there's an expectation of raising interest rates, your discounted cash flows are going to change. You're just dividing by a higher number. So tech companies tend to produce a lot of cash flow in the outer years, 5, 10, 15, 20 years in the future. And if you divide by a non-trivial number, the valuations are just going to change. It has nothing to do with the performance of these companies, as far as I can tell. It's just a simple discounted cash flow analysis. And basically, nobody was discounting the credit as a value by any meaningful number until inflation started kicking in. It was obvious to everybody, which means interest rates must go up.
But it certainly seems to be impacting some stocks more than others. I mentioned Shopify is still up about 15% for the year. I think that's also true of Adobe, even after the pullback after its earnings. Both of those have some play in e-commerce, you know, Shopify especially. But there's also a broader idea that they're changing the game. I guess you could say that a lot about a lot of these companies. What do you think accounts for the difference in the degree of these pullbacks?
Well, some of it's just cash flow expectations, like how far out are the cash flows that are material, whether they're 3 years, like let's say Adobe, for example, probably sooner rather than later. Some are further out in the future, more high growth, very high tech companies where a lot of the profits are, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years into the future. So that may account for some. Obviously, there's micro performance. There clearly are some stocks, some companies, some equities that are going to outperform others, that better management teams, better potential in the market. But if you look at the effects, some of the best run companies that I'm familiar with, DoorDash, you know, has been significantly affected. Square has been significantly affected. So I don't know, you know, exactly what's driving the, you know, the alpha versus the beta. But I think if you just did the discounted cash flow analysis per company, you could get to 80% of the right answer.
You know, Keith, you mentioned Shopify. I want to get you to tell us a little bit about your new roll-up of Shopify merchants. OpenStore just hit a $750 million valuation. What's the opportunity that you see there over the long term? And how is this different from what we're seeing in the roll-ups of Amazon merchants with companies such as Thrasio?
Sure. So absolutely. If you take a step back over the last decade, the most impressive tech story, other than maybe SpaceX, is Shopify. You know, out of nowhere, Shopify has constructed a $150 to $180 billion company right down the middle of the sweet spot of Amazon. So basically betraying this myth that Amazon has all this pseudo-monopoly power that all these politicians talk about. Shopify has created a direct competitor over the last decade that's doing better than Amazon. So the biggest trend is building a new, vibrant entrepreneurial endeavor through creating a Shopify store. So when I looked at that, I said, wow, okay, great. There's this macro trend of everybody starting a business on Shopify. Well, guess what? Only a small fraction of those businesses are going to be explosive enough for venture capital, like my day job. One out of every 100, one out of every 1,000 maybe. In fact, there's two or three public companies that were built off of Shopify. But the average entrepreneur that starts a business on Shopify sells less than $10 million of sales. It isn't exploding, and they don't really have access to debt. So that those entrepreneurs have two choices. They can run the business forever, decades, or they have, you know, sort of no option for liquidity. And I said, well, guess what? We're going to create options for liquidity. So we're going to instantly underwrite these businesses using just data, same day, give people an offer. And whenever they decide, the entrepreneur, the proprietor, the founder decides that he or she no longer wants to run the business, we'll give them liquidity and buy them out. And so that encourages more people to start businesses on Shopify because they now know there's light at the end of the tunnel. They don't have to wait for some generational transfer, like, you know, their son or daughter taking over the business, or they don't have to commit the rest of their lives to something. So that's the most important thing. Compared to Amazon roll-up startups, and there's like 13, 14, or 15 of them all trying to do financial engineering. It's basically new age private equity. Basically, we're going to buy low EBITDA and sell high. with the market being at its height 6 months ago, there was an arbitrage opportunity between EBITDAs that they can acquire businesses at on Amazon and what they hope to trade at. I think that arbitrage opportunity has been materially compressed.
Hey, Keith, on a separate note, Reuters has a piece out this morning citing sources that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is going to demand that buy now, pay later firms give more detail about product offerings, how they use their consumer data. I wonder if you think the sector is going to come under pressure to provide more transparency in general.
Well, in general, that may be true. I am sure that a firm is at the cutting edge of the transparency movement. We've been very cooperative and collaborative with, you know, various regulators over the years. I think we provide more transparency than any other instrument that you could possibly use. So I'm very comfortable with increasing regulation in this particular case. The rest of the sector, you know, may see issues and challenges.
I would be curious to hear your thoughts on Reddit, knowing that you were on the board there for many years. As we look towards that IPO, what do you think the biggest risks are? Do you think it's about reform of Section 230 and the platform being held accountable for more of the content that happens on the platform? What should investors be watching out for?
I think Reddit's a great company. It's sort of been under the radar, and now maybe people in the public markets and the rest of the world will appreciate Reddit. It's been this, you know, it's had a larger audience than, like, for example, Twitter for 5, 6, 7, 8 years, but nobody was giving us credit back, you know, back when I was on the board. And so fundamentally, I think people will appreciate the value of Reddit, which is unique content across any vertical. So whether you're into equities, whether you're into politics, whether you're into the Buffalo Bills or the Dallas Cowboys, the best possible content you can find anywhere is on Reddit. And so I think that is the magic of Reddit. Now, from a regulatory perspective, I don't believe that there's going to be significant changes in the Section 230 liability. I think there's too many important companies and too many consumer expectations baked into the protections that 230 affords. And so I think there's a lot of noise around it, but in practice, no one's really come up with a better idea that's going to protect the last 20 years of American history.
Interesting. A bet on Congress barking more than it bites. That often
Which
pans out.
Wouldn't be the first time.
Wouldn't be the first time. For sure. Keith, thank you.
Pleasure.
A little more on fintech now. I talked to Credit Karma founder and CEO Ken Lin yesterday with this month the 1 year anniversary of the closing of Intuit's $8 billion deal to buy the company. Now, you might not remember, those two companies announced that deal right as the pandemic was hitting the U.S. in 2020. Today, Credit Karma is doing more than $1 billion in annual revenue and was a highlight of Intuit's most recent earnings. But behind the scenes, as the pandemic was setting in, many people advising Lin thought it all would fall apart. But Intuit CEO Sasan Goodarzi called Ken, assured him that Intuit would honor its commitment, and Ken trusted him.
Sasan at that point had been relatively new in the role, right? He'd just taken over the CEO role within, I think, the last 2 years. But with that said, Sasan and I had spent the last, you know, a year and a half of those 2 years building trust and rapport and relationship before we ever entered into the agreement. So I think that was hugely impactful. And I think, well, not what I think, when I had that conversation with Sasan, that direct conversation and his, you know, adamant reinforcement about, like, this is what we're doing, I felt really good about it. Now, and I'm sure my board, you know, when they heard me say this, like, oh, you're being naive. And of course, what else is he going to say? But I think to your point around trust, I mean, that certainly comes into play. And I think the other thing about these really hard decisions, yeah, it's not data. It's gut, it's trust, and it's principles and values.
Yeah, data can't solve every problem. You can watch the full conversation on Tech Check's Twitter page at CNBC Tech Check or on our LinkedIn page. Julia, you know, these pandemics and upheaval, they have real impact behind the scenes on where the deals get done.
Yeah, the drama of deal making, it's all about those interpersonal relationships and those conversations increasingly happening on Zoom, although we'll see if they start to happen more in person again. Now, coming up, closing arguments kicking off in the trial against Elizabeth Holmes. We will take you live to the courthouse. Do not go away. You don't want to miss it. is the latest battle in the streaming wars. And this one is not about competition between streamers, but between content owners and carriers in the battles over fees. YouTube TV's deal with Disney is set to expire Friday night. YouTube warning its subscribers that they could lose access to its 18 Disney-owned channels, including ESPN, FX, and ABC, both their live and their on-demand content. Now, that's a big chunk of YouTube TV's lineup. And the streamer, which says it's in active conversations, does seem anxious about losing subscribers, saying it will lower the monthly price for its service by $15 to $50 a month for however long that the content is off the platform. YouTube saying in a blog post that subscribers could spend $14 a month for a bundle of Disney Plus, ESPN Plus, and Hulu. That offer, sign up to get the same content directly from Disney, is exactly why this is complicated. Content prices are high, and suppliers are also distributors themselves. So Disney is saying in a statement that they are optimistic they can reach a deal, but analyst Barton Crockett, he tells us he predicts YouTube will give Disney ESPN most of what they want. But he says that the long-term downward trend in viewership means that there could come a day when major distributors forego Disney and ESPN, and Disney would have to rely much more on its direct-to-consumer relationship. So Carl will be watching to see if those channels go dark tomorrow night.
Yeah, it's a huge issue, especially given the fact that as more platforms arise, they want to keep whatever content. I mean, SNL is a great example on Hulu versus Peacock. And some of the recent calls, Julia, on Disney specifically argue that if they can't make DTC work profitably, that there could be, in the words of one firm earlier in the week, 30% downside. So there's a real material nature to this dynamic.
Yeah, and CEO Bob Chapek has made it clear that going direct to consumer, owning that relationship, is really crucial to his management and his plan going forward.
Yeah, fascinating. A very complicated thing to understand in the media business right now. Still to come, Apple, as you may know, delaying its return to the office. But first, we asked leaders at our CNBC Technology Executive Council Summit to weigh in on where the biggest investments in tech will be in the coming year. Take a listen.
Changing an organization is like moving a mountain, and I think we need to change the education system.
Battery is going to be one area for sure. Quantum computing is going to be another one. We're getting a few questions on there as well.
But for us, of course, cybersecurity is the main focus on how to stay resilient.
Cyber attacks, there were a lot of headlines that were made over the past year, and unfortunately, we don't think they're going to be going away anytime soon.
Closing arguments in the trial of Elizabeth Holmes start today. Scott Cohn's outside the courthouse, as he has been for much of this trial. Scott?
Good morning, John. Getting underway any moment now, the culmination of a trial that began at the end of August. Elizabeth Holmes is here, along with several members of her family, including her parents. If you want to get a sense of how hot a ticket this is, these closing arguments, people began lining up here in San Jose before 2 o'clock this morning. They are still lined up to get inside as this trial moves to a close. What we expect will happen today, first we will hear from the government, which will argue that Elizabeth Holmes knowingly lied to investors and patients about the capabilities of her blood testing firm Theranos. The defense will argue that she did not intend to defraud anyone. She was relying on her experts and she honestly believed in it. She faces 11 counts, as you can see. They include 2 counts of conspiracy to defraud Theranos investors and Theranos patients, and then 9 substantive counts of actual wire fraud, including investors, including the likes of Henry Kissinger, former Defense Secretary James Mattis, Rupert Murdoch, and wire fraud against Theranos patients who received erroneous false test results because of the flawed technology, allegedly, according to the government. The jury, 8 men and 4 women, will then retire to the jury room with this verdict form, but getting from here to there is going to take some time. They have 13 weeks of testimony to sort through, hundreds of exhibits, and including the testimony of Elizabeth Holmes herself, who was on the stand for 7 days throughout this trial. So what we expect will happen, the government will go first today, followed by the defense. They will likely continue into tomorrow. The government then gets a rebuttal. Then the judge will instruct the jury, which could get the case by the end of the day tomorrow. How long will deliberations go? Well, that is anybody's guess. Guys?
going to be fascinating to watch. You know, juries like to wrap these things up before the holidays. So curious to see how fast they come to an agreement. Thanks so much. Yeah. Really appreciate it. Okay. And as we head to break, check out AT&T, an upgrade at Morgan Stanley. They say the recent underperformance has created an attractive risk-reward opportunity. Guess it depends on how you define recent. Take a look at this five-year chart. It's down 43%. The S&P has doubled in that time period. And it's up 6.5% today on that upgrade. We're back in a moment.
Welcome back. Apple, as you may know, temporarily closing three retail locations due to a rise in COVID cases. Got a store in Miami, Ottawa, Ontario, and Annapolis will remain closed today and tomorrow. Apple said that store employees will take COVID-19 tests, and depending on the results, a reopening could be postponed. At the same time, Apple's delaying its corporate return to office plans indefinitely while giving employees $1,000 to buy home office equipment, John. We talk about PC sales and what the trajectory is for 2022. Maybe don't discount it out yet.
That's true. And Carl, I wonder whether this is ripping up the playbook or if this is the new playbook. We've talked a lot about where what's going to happen with Omicron, Julia. And I think a question is, do we businesses figure out ways to operate despite the pandemic, or do they shut down and stop operating? More and more, it seems like companies are figuring out ways and using the pandemic playbook versus ripping it up, but we'll see.
Yeah, this is the new normal, figuring out new solutions, new flexibility. I think it's really hard to plan ahead. I've seen so many companies cancel things, cancel meetings, people getting sick just in the past couple of days. And I do think there's a sense that we still don't know, John, just how bad Omicron is going to be and what the implications could be for a holiday wave.
Yep. Now, we've got CNBC's Eamon Jabbers next, so let's do one more thing now. Maybe J-Lo should watch out. H&R Block is suing Block, the company formerly known as Square, for trademark infringement. H&R Block arguing Block competes directly against H&R Block in a number of areas, including tax filing and debit cards. And the company also cited a number of its marketing campaigns, including It's Better with Block, Block Has Your Back, and Make Every Block Better. Here is the new Block logo. Not very green, but here is the website for Cash App Taxes. H&R Block is objecting to the green square on the top left, which they say is too similar to the green square logo of H&R Block. We have reached out to Block for comment. Up here next on Tech Check, a section we call the G Block. No word on whether Jenny from the Block is also threatened with infringement. We'll be right back. We continue to follow the story of the Log4j vulnerability, a massive security flaw that could, in the words of one expert, haunt the internet for years. Eamon Jabbers just sat down with the director of Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency and joins us now. Eamon.
John, this was the first time that Jen Easterly had sat down for an on-camera interview since this Log4j vulnerability became public last week, and what she had to say was concerning. Take a listen.
The Log4j vulnerability is the most serious vulnerability that I've seen in my decades-long career. Everyone should assume that they are exposed and vulnerable and to check and make sure that they're not vulnerable.
She calls it the most serious vulnerability she has seen in her decades-long career. Reminder, that career includes stints at the NSA, also at the U.S. Army, posted in Baghdad, setting up U.S. Cyber Command. This is an official who has seen a lot of vulnerabilities in her time, and she's calling this one the most serious. I asked her what to expect and what they've learned so far about Log4j, and here's what she said.
My view is we are going to see widespread exploitation by all manner of threat actors and likely impacts on both public and private infrastructure. We're doing everything we can with our partners to get ahead of that. But we're going to be dealing with this vulnerability, Eamon, for a very long time. This is not something that is going to be patched and finished. This is something that we're going to be working on likely for months, if not years.
So a lot here for corporate America to worry about, guys. Back over to you.
Yeah, Powell said as much yesterday, Eamon. That's good stuff. Eamon Jabbers.
You've been listening to CNBC's Tech Check. You can always catch us live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern.